so far, so hard to go. Hey Blake.
Hey Kayla.
We're back.
We are
back. For the final episode of season 4.
Oh, can you believe it? We made it to the season finale.
The season finale. The end of this season. Will it be the last season? We don't know. But we made it to the end of this one. We made it to the end of this one, and we're so excited for this episode.
Yes, so excited. Like, could not imagine a better, more fitting way to end this season. We are always excited about our guests and have had brilliant guests over 4 seasons, brilliant guests this year. But we are really ending with a bang with one of our favorite guests that we've ever had on the podcast, who's back for a swing as a returning champ on Under the Arch.
And, yes.
She requires very, very little introduction, because you all know her and love her. She is our Congresswoman Cori Bush.
Cori in the house.
Yay.
Cori in the house. Welcome to the podcast, Congresswoman. Yay. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for inviting me back. You know, it's always good to talk to home. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I need home.
Home is so grateful for you. Home is so grateful for you, always on the front lines of the most important issues and conversations and policies that our nation needs to reckon with. So thank you for making time for us, because we know that you are quite busy fighting the right.
Yes.
For real.
Yeah, we so appreciate it. And there's never a bad time. I mean, we could always talk about a million things. And you, one of the things that I think is just amazing about you is you make time to have about a million different fights at once. Somehow you are in all the right fights at the right times. But one of the particular fights, and that is the truth. But one of the particular fights that we really wanted to talk to you about is around reparations, because this has been, I think, really an ascendant topic over the past few years, really, in particular, federally in various locales. We have our own process that I'll let Kayla speak to a little more later here in St. Louis. But you introduced a resolution around reparations. Was that last month? When was that?
It was in May.
Okay.
We wanted to do it a month before Juneteenth so we could start to push it out.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So can you give us maybe a little, before we dive into the details of it, can you give us a little of the backdrop of, like, what led up to that? What made you want to bring that resolution? And what were some of the prior efforts in Congress that led up to that?
Even before ever entering Congress, I think about back when I was a child. You know, my dad would teach us, you know, African history. He would teach us African American history, and then also, you know, some U.S. history. But he would teach us from the standpoint of what's missing. But he was really, really great at making sure we understood who Black folks were before the transatlantic slave trade. You know, that we were a whole people, that we had our own culture and traditions and our own livelihoods, that we were, again, whole. And so just moving forward and going to school, I went to Carter-Ritter College Prep. And at Carter-Ritter, we had a leadership class that we had to take. They taught us more about Black history. And I just remember just feeling helpless, and like hearing the things that had happened, book after book in the archives, my dad making us watch Eyes on the Prize. You know, we didn't sit up and watch anything else on the TV with dad. You know, if you were watching TV with dad, it was Eyes on the Prize. You were picking an episode, or it was Roots, one of the Roots episodes, you know? And so that was our learning. And I felt like I needed to, if I ever got into a position where I could affect change, to be able to make sure that this country righted the wrong, at least to the point where it could, because righting the wrong really would be it not ever happening. But, you know, but some type of repair, that I would do what I could to make it happen. And so running for Congress, it was part of what I said that I would do. Even working with an organization who's still doing that work now called the Truth Telling Project, I felt like now that I'm in this position and I have the power of the pen and I have the power of the purse, and I have this bully pulpit to push for that which we need. This is not something that, you know, we want because other people have had it, or we want it because it sounds good. It's a good talking point to get people riled up. No, this is owed to over 40 million people in this country.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I, you know, we so appreciate Mr. Bush for just always, every time I see him, he's like still in the work, still in the community, still, yes, talking about that we need to, I just saw him at Black Wall Street. And he was talking about, yeah, the Reparations Commission. And so it's just so important that history be taught. And we know that we live in a time where it's actually being erased out of formal education. So it's even more important that we have this sort of fugitive education where we're thinking about how we have grassroots and informal processes that give that education to our young people so that they grow up knowing that history. So thank you for that. And so, you know, were there, when you and your team were crafting this important resolution, were there any things that you thought that were especially important to include or avoid in crafting the resolution? I was about to say revolution, that too, but the resolution.
Yeah. So a few things. So one, as both of you know, I was not going to step out and do this without doing this work with the people who do this work. So that's just something, you know, we all learned that a long time ago, that you bring the people to the table who are doing the work, the people that are soaking into it, you know, you bring movement to the table. So that was first. And the thing is, we understood that in order for us to do this the right way, we have to talk to people who are on all sides of what of this reparations work. And we know that there are differing opinions, but I could not be one to push and roll out something where I didn't have everybody that we could at the table working to bring forward some type of legislation where we all could feel like we're a part of it. The other thing is, I didn't want to just do something that talked about direct payments. But I didn't want to do something that did not talk about direct payments, because I'm for direct payments and I'm for resources for our communities, because I don't feel that just giving a cash payment will fix the harm and will have the lasting effect that we seek, because this is not just, it's about chattel slavery, but it's also about the vestiges of slavery. It's also about that institutionalized racism that we walk through and that we have to, that discrimination that we live through every single day. And so this resolution, we wanted to make it clear that I need you to not only hear what we're saying that should happen, we want you to know the history of what happened, because we want you to pick this resolution up, read it, and understand why we're making this argument, why we believe that this is old, and then also give that minimum scope of financial reparations, like what that could look like. So we wanted to put it all there. This is a history lesson, not only for people who who've never had a Black history class. You know, this is a history lesson for everyone.
Yeah, and it really, I mean, one of the things I love about the way that you and your team and whomever you worked with on the resolution that this is designed is that it does serve as such a history lesson. I mean, the whole, I really want to say to listeners, Google, find this resolution, read the whole thing. It is worth taking the time to find it and read it. and share it with other folks, precisely for that reason, because it's such a history lesson where you've included information, as you're saying, not only about slavery, of course, about chattel slavery, but not only about slavery, but about political exploitation, about economic extraction, about, there's
the long history of reproduction
and the use of the federal, criminal mechanisms against Black people. Like it is this just huge sketch of the ways that policy and in some cases private actors have come together to strip Black people of dignity, of property, of wealth, of security. And then it just lands in this statement that, you know, after the case is laid so bare, it lands in this statement that, and so reparations are due. And so I just appreciate the emphasis on, you know, and what you said just now, not just slavery, but the vestiges of slavery, because I think that the vestiges unfortunately get lost sometimes in conversations about reparations, and we're only talking about slavery. So I so appreciate that, and would love to hear you speak to, you know, what impact you are hoping to have by doing that. You know, this obviously isn't the first time, even in Congress, it's not the first effort, and you reference other efforts in the resolution to generate action around reparations. So what was your aim with this resolution?
Having language like this that you find in this resolution entered into the congressional record, this is in legislation, this is the first time ever that it's been laid out this way. Mm-hmm. So first of all, we needed to make it clear what happened, and understanding that this isn't all. This is a place for people to start and to go, you know, to get a whereas clause and go and research this one point, you know, and then go to the next and research the next point. But also, we wanted to call a thing a thing. And so when we hear people say, oh, you know, the federal government, you know, doesn't owe anything, you know, to people, because the federal government, you know, like, we weren't here when this is what I get. We, you know, we weren't alive then, and we didn't enslave you. You were never a slave. Like, this is what I've heard. But the thing is, when I say, okay, but in this resolution, when we talk about, if you want to say that the federal government does not have a place here, if we only start by the fact that the 10 out of the first 12 U.S. presidents all enslaved Black folks, that James K. Polk, as president, he traded enslaved Black folks from the Oval Office when 1,700 members of Congress between the 18th and 20th centuries enslaved Black folks. Congressmen, there were more congressmen who enslaved Black people than there are Black folks who've been Congress members. When we talk about how the government made the decision, the federal government provided reparations to white slave owners, you know, through the Compensated Emancipation Act of 1862, right in D.C. I'm in D.C. every day. They gave reparations to white enslavers, saying, hey, if you free your enslaved Black folks, we know that you're going to suffer some harm. So, you know what? We're going to give you some reparations so that you won't be, so you won't suffer when you free your enslaved Black folks. But they did not give reparations to those who were being freed. What they did say was, if you leave the country, we'll help you. If you want to leave the country, you get out of the United States, then we'll help you. This is why we had to put all of that information here in this resolution, but then also pull it forward to talking about race massacres, you know, because it wasn't just, so it was what happened with chattel slavery, but then it was, you know, Jim Crow and also post Jim Crow. If we don't make it loud and clear, this resolution says that the U.S. federal government has a moral and legal obligations to provide reparations to the descendants of enslaved folks in this country. If we don't put that out and make it clear, in this resolution, it even talks about the United Nations saying, the United Nations came out and said, you know, how egregious slavery was and that the U.S. had needed to repair that harm. Why has it not happened yet? And so that's what this resolution says. It gives it so that people who say that the federal government did not have a place here, it was just people that says that, hey, there was no real benefit. Like, you know, they're saying right now, what was it that DeSantis said that you know, black folks, we benefit, there was a benefit to slavery. Well, we show the line of how there was not a benefit. There was only rape. There was only harm. There was only massacre after massacre. We show how black folks were excluded from when we talk about Social Security, you know, and other ways where black folks could have had some gain. But it also talks about how white folks gained through land grants. And so we give a big history.
Yeah, it's such an important and it's so, it also is just so detailed. It talks about the mortality rates, right, and the black maternal rates of inside during the enslavement period, right? And it talks about even now these realities. And I just think it ends so powerfully, right? Where therefore it be resolved that the House of Representatives recognize the responsibilities of the federal government to provide reparations in many forms, right? And it talks about, yes, the respect and a human right to self-determination and freedom from discrimination, including with respect to housing, health, education, life, security of person, water and sanitation, and a healthy environment, while encouraging the passage and implementation of H.R. 40, which has been a longstanding piece of legislation toward creating a true process to study the history and the case for reparation. So I just think it does such a powerful job of giving that history. I wanted to ask you, you know, so now that it's been introduced and out for some time, how has it been received by inside of the House and just in the general public?
So in the House, as far as Democrats are concerned, it's been received well. We have support coming out of the Congressional Black Caucus, of course, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, who is the sponsor of H.R. 40. And then we have a lot of my colleagues who have signed on, but we're still working. We're still working because some, you know, when people saw the $14 trillion number, which is the approximate, what's been approximately calculated as the black-white wealth gap by experts like Sandy Darity and Jason Hinkle and others, you know, some folks were like, hey, you know, you put a number to it. Well, we didn't put a number to it. What we did was we made it clear what the wealth gap, what that wealth gap is. And in a just country, why would there be a gap, a $14 trillion gap in wealth just simply based upon race? When we also understand that there were, and I make the case that over 222 million hours of forced labor, that is what chattel slavery, that's how many hours that have been calculated from 1619 to 1865, which today is at a value of over $97 trillion. So if the value of it, if we just record and look at the hours, the hours alone is $97 trillion, but the wealth gap is $14 trillion. People need not be upset at the $14 trillion because we could have said 97. We could have started there, you know. But when we look at the other side of the aisle, like right now, there is no conversation. But for me, not only with Black community members, Black folks in Congress, anybody who represents a community that has been marginalized in this country, I'm saying, and I have said, they should be the first ones stepping up saying that we support this. And so that's going to be another part of my work is when we come back, is reaching out to those other caucuses saying, hey, like, you should be locked locked arms with us for this resolution, because we're not talking about something that did not even happen in this country. We're talking about something that happened to people. And I always have to remind people, we're talking about folks who were kidnapped, you know, and stolen and robbed of their cultures, snatched from their family members over and over again, who didn't even speak the language, who were forced by this country. It is written, we're forced by this country. When I think about even the Dred Scott case, and we, you know, we talk a lot about that, especially in St. Louis, you know, we're doing actions and stuff. We bring up that Dred Scott v. Sanford decision, and we talk about it, but when I think, really, really think about how those five justices that heard that case and decided it, five of them were enslavers themselves, enslavers of Black folks right here, you know, right here. That happened here, you know, where they were able to make this decision that Black folks were not citizens of the United States. You know, and so all of the ways that white supremacy has been institutionalized, that it has been codified into the thread of this country, that is the work that I have to like put before these members of Congress to make them see, like, this is not something that it's not going to go away. So we'll keep working. You know, we'll keep working. We won't, and I can't let what day an election is coming stop me from pushing this, because every 2 years there's always going to be another U.S. House of Representatives election, and every four there will always be another presidential election. So we can't talk about this right now, because we got to get folks reelected. No, if you talk about it and do something about it, then finally we can move from it. So do the right thing now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Yeah. We are going to just, you know, let that sit with our listeners, because it's just so powerful how you laid that out, and how the resolution lays it out. We're going to take just a very quick break and return with our very special guest, Congresswoman Corey Bush. You are listening to Under the Arch. Welcome back to Under the Arch. We're still a podcast where we explore the issues facing our community and the people fighting to transform them. You just heard our Music Minute, Beach Journey by the Caleb Kirby Quintet. You can find their music wherever you listen to your streaming services. We are back with Congresswoman Corey Bush inside of a very powerful episode of Under the Arch, where we're talking about her Reparations Now resolution. Let's get back into it.
Yeah, I have a question about just how you see this federal effort relating to other efforts. So as I kind of teed up at the top, there are cities and states across the country now that have their own reparations processes, commissions, and otherwise playing out. And St. Louis is one of those cities, thankfully, very proudly. Now have a brilliant reparations commission chaired by the one and only Kayla Reed, and some really amazing commissioners, knowledgeable, dedicated folks who are gathering testimonies and information, and are going to be producing a report, but my question really is how you see the federal efforts like yours relating to local efforts, if you see them relating in some way, how you see those things relating or would like for them to relate.
Oh, absolutely. So that is a part of this legislation is using it as to help with momentum with local and state governments, but also working in collaboration with those that are trying to put together those commissions and other folks have task force, where we want this reparations bill to look to be like a way for people, for those that are trying to do this work in communities where they may not have a lot of support, to be able to look and say, right now, this is happening on the federal level. So we want to do this work on the local level. It provides a bit of cover in that way, but it also gives us, this is also momentum for us when local communities are pushing forward themselves. Because what I've been able to say is, look, because the federal government has not moved, not even to get a study of reparations. It's been around 40 years and we still don't even have a study. So the local communities have decided to take it upon themselves. And we saw, you know, a great example in Evanston, Illinois, but also what's been happening in California, San Francisco specifically. We have a North Carolina, Boston just put together a commission. I don't know if we call it a commission or if it's like a task force, but it's happening in other places across the country. We're seeing it pretty widespread. So what we know is that people are making the decision that we won't wait on the federal government. And so I love it that folks just like in St. Louis made the decision, if they won't take care of our people, we'll do it ourselves. But which, yes, move forward with that, do that. But and that helps us to be able to push, like I've been able to do when people were like, well, why are you putting this together? Like, why do you feel like you should be the one to bring about such a resolution? You just got to Congress, you know, and all of that kind of crap. So, but for me, it was, first of all, I'm Black and I'm a descendant of enslaved Black folks in this country on both sides of my family. But even if I wasn't, I'm the one that decided to do it. But two, because in my community, there is a push for reparations. Right in my community, they are working right now. They've been galvanizing right now. And so I've been able to say, hey, this is not only just me. It's not only because I feel it in my bones. I could feel the weeping of my ancestors in my bones. You know, I could feel it when I go to Mississippi and I'm driving down the highway. I can feel there is something that just I can just feel this presence, you know, and it's just so heavy on me. And I know I can't turn back when I'm walking down the halls in those halls of Congress. I literally can feel the our ancestors like saying to me, hold your shoulders back, hold your head up, like we built this, you know, you walk tall, even though the on the walls the portraits don't look like you, you hold your arms back. That's where I feel the connection is, local, state, and federal. We have to have all three working together to be able to get the momentum to get this done. We like, what time is it if not now? And it's now because we're here and because we choose to do this work and pick up this mantle that folks championed before us.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the last question I want to ask about reparations, Congresswoman, is for folks who are listening and who have read the Reparations Now resolution, are in our region and are coming to the commission meetings, the local ones, and are like, we need both of these things at the same time. How do they get involved with the Reparations Now resolution? Or for our listeners who are not just in St. Louis, how can folks get involved around this resolution?
Yeah, great question. So one thing that you can do is we have listed out the organizations who we've partnered with. Many of them like worked on the legislation with us. Like we took, you know, we worked together on ideas and language. So you could connect with one of those organizations or you could also call our office and we can work with you and talk to you about your own community, what it is you may want to do. If you need help, we can also work to connect you with other folks, other organizations or local governments that are doing this work to help if they could be a resource. So you can always feel free to call our office at 314-955-9980.
Wonderful. Okay, we're going to, in the remaining time, switch gears just a little bit while we have the good fortune and privilege of being in conversation with you. We want to ask about a couple of other things. As we said at the top, you know, some Congress people just do one thing a year. You do 50 things a year. And just last week, you also co-sponsored a piece of legislation to end solitary confinement in federal prisons. And so this is something that is very near to our hearts and our organizations. In solidarity with people who are behind cages all over this country and all over the world. And we have seen local versions of solitary confinement. We've seen how devastating it can be to people. What made this an issue that you wanted to take up? And what are you seeking to do with the bill that was introduced last week?
Yeah, so I spend a lot of time thinking about what affects our communities and who's doing something about it and how long has this been an issue and is there something that I can do about it? And so we just look at like where is injustice, just period. And of course, the prison system is an area where that I've been trying to highlight the atrocities that happen. And I've been doing that since before entering Congress. So solitary confinement is a piece of that, you know, understanding that this is an area where people are tortured, you know, solitary confinement, it is actual torture. In our work is to first save lives. I always say it to people. I start by looking at, first of all, doing the most for every single person in St. Louis, in our district, starting with those who have the greatest need. But I have to do it by saving your life first. And so understanding that solitary confinement leads to death many times. And so this torture, it's cruel. It's unjust, it's inhumane, it's a punishment that is so severe that the repercussions, you know, on people's mental health and physical health are so long term that it can end in death. And when we understand that we're talking about over 100,000 people, it's like 122,000 people on any given day are locked in solitary confinement. And whatever the name is, let's be clear, there are other names for solitary confinement. I think it's like administrative detention and there are other names for it. But 122,000 people, 11,000 of them in federal facilities. But that disproportionately impacts women, LGBTQ folks, Black, Brown, you know, young folks and people living with disabilities. And so our work has to be, we're always talking about the same groups of people being attacked and being disproportionately harmed and being the ones who always have to get the brunt of the worst of what this society offers. And I'm so done with it. I'm so done with it. And so every single place where we can find white supremacy and the patriarchy or unjust practices, this is what we're going to do. And so I won't wait. Just like where I'm from, the people of St. Louis, we have learned we're not waiting on other people to do for us what we can do for ourselves. And so I introduced the End Solitary Confinement Act last week because I want this country to abolish this inhumane practice. And it would end solitary in federal prisons and detention facilities. So it wouldn't end it in state facilities. But if we can get a resolution that ends it on the federal level, federal prisons, then we can see work happen on our in our state prisons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I know Kayla's going to land us with a final question. I just want to say thank you for making the point of it doesn't matter what you call it, because we get caught up in that with solitary confinement. And they say it's not solitary. It's administrative segregation. It's administrative detention. And as you said earlier, let's call a thing a thing. So I just want to appreciate you for naming that.
Absolutely. We only have you for a few more minutes. And, you know, I'm so grateful that you are our last guest of this season. And so this entire season, we've been on this roadmap of explaining the what's right, the boogeymans, the bad things that are happening nationally, the attacks on critical race theory, the attack on queer and trans people. We've talked about visionary work around our housing and reparations, but it's hard. It's hard right now. It's hard to be in the role of an organizer or an activist or just a concerned community member and find inspiration. And so knowing that this is the last episode of season four for us, what I just hope I could ask of you is, what would you want to say to St. Louis right now as we are just dealing with all of this imminent attack, these imminent attacks, these constant attacks on our families and friends and loved ones? Where do you find hope, and where should we be looking for that same hope?
So for me, the hope is because we are still here. And that's what I look at. The hope is because we are still here. So then that means that there is a chance. There is change that is inevitable, in my opinion, because we won't stop. You know, we could have, St. Louis could have seen so many people stop fighting years ago when things were really, really hard happening right in our own community. But we didn't. And we learned from it, and we grew, and we worked together. And now we're doing so much more of that. We are affecting not only St. Louis, but people across the country and our world. And so that hope is we're still here, so we're able to fight. And I know the attacks come every day, all day long. It's unbelievable what's happening. And even in Congress every day, it's a violent place to be. It is it's a very racist, bigoted, hateful environment, which is what people are also experiencing away from the Hill. But this is the thing. They win when we stop. They win when we won't speak up. Just like I said on the floor of the House the other day, you know, as we're hearing this rhetoric, oh, Democrats don't want to work. Democrats aren't doing this. Democrats aren't doing that. You know what? And I say, I had to, even though I didn't have a microphone, I had to yell out to say, your bills are racist. That's why we're not supporting these, because of what you're trying to strip DEI, which is what we need. It's a piece of what we need. It was DEI in our schools. You want to go against CRT and don't even know what it is. You know, you want to ban books, you know, because those books teach, you know, because we're able to learn and to grow from those books. Anything that is not in a line with this right agenda, they want to snatch away. And they also want to hurt our communities by taking away Social Security, by messing with SNAP and EBT. And I can't sit back and allow it without speaking up and using all that I have. And so there's so many other people that are doing that same work. We won't stop fighting for you the same way we know you won't stop fighting for yours. So as you tell us what you need, we can go and take that further. We can continue to work with you. We won't stop this fight. And this is the thing. We won't back down, because backing down means, again, that they win. And so there's absolutely no scenario of what is going on right now where we allow them to win. It won't happen. So regardless of what the attacks look like, St. Louis, regardless of how heavy it is and how much it hurts and how, you know, disenfranchising it may be, and how disappointing, you know, how disillusioned even the people around you become, you hold fast knowing that time will change, that this will change, because we got here. So time will change, things will change, people will change, as long as we change it. That arc pulling toward it, yes, we need that moral arc, and we need to pull it. We pull it towards justice. We make that arc bend. And so that's what you do. I love you. always understand your congresswoman loves you to the point to where I fight for you with my whole life.
Congresswoman Cori Bush, thank you, thank you, thank you for who you are and what you do. Thank you for that message of hope. And thank you so much for being here with us today. We so appreciate you, appreciate your time. And
just want to say that we find hope in you, you know, that it is,
thank you.
It is a hard cross to bear to always need to be the inspirational one. Right. It is a hard cross to bear to always have to be on the front lines. But we are grateful for your ascension into this role because it reflects the heart and soul of our movement here in St. Louis. And so every day that you fight, just know we'll be right here with you fighting because I believe we will win. That's what we've been saying since 2014. And I still believe it.
That's right.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to take one final break to our listeners. Kayla and I will be back. And you have been listening to a very special conversation with Congresswoman Cori Bush here on Under the Arch.
Welcome back.
What a way to wrap up this season.
Ooh, some tears were shed.
Yes.
In that last portion with Congresswoman Bush.
Yeah.
And it just is such a mandate to remember that we, you know, the arc doesn't just bend, we do pull it, right? Mm-hmm. We do pull it. And that is such a necessary frame to remember in this time, because this season we brought up a lot of hard things, Blake. We really have.
Yes. And you never know what people are trying to hold while bending that arc. Mm-hmm. You know, that is hard work. It's hard spirit work, emotional work, psychological work, relational work. Mm-hmm. And folks doing that hard work are going through it. And so, you know, the reason we talk so much, you know, movement spaces can be touchy-feely spaces, but it's because love is needed.
That love is needed. And we are what we have, you know? We have each other. They have all the resources and avenues of influence, and what we have is people. We have each other. We have to remember to take care of our people, right? And as people, to take care of ourselves, because this work is brutal, and it's hard right now. It's so violent and just unabashed in this way of just existing and infiltrating every walk of life. It's like you just can't be, you know. It's the name Twitter's changed his name. It's like everywhere you look, it's something going on, you know. Everywhere you look, there's something going on. I'm like, what happened to Twitter, Jesus, you know?
Yes.
But I'm grateful for Congresswoman Bush and laying out that piece around hope. And, you know, I like to ask you these types of questions too, Blake, because I find you to be one of, you know, you're so clear all the time. So where do you find? Yeah, I think you're very clear. Well, you know, hey, on the outside, from the outside, you're clear. I don't know what's happening on the inside, but on the outside, you're clear. Where are you finding hope as we get ready to wrap up season 4 for our listeners? Where do you find hope in this work?
You know, I always try to remember two things and lean on two things. And one is from my vantage point at Arch City, having the mandate and the privilege of working with the clients and community members that we get to work with, who are surviving more every day than many of us have ever really had to face. And I count myself among those, that it really is a great privilege to be entrusted to help people in times of crisis and to see people dig so deep to help themselves in times of crisis, that I find a lot of hope in that, and in watching people organize and build power and step into their own power. And the other is You know, I try to be a student of history, and I try to remember where I come from and where my family and my people come from and what we have survived. And it's hard when you look at that legacy, not to know that we come from unimaginably strong stock and can do anything. And so I find a lot of hope in that. Yeah. What about you, Kayla?
I told you not to ask me that question during the break, but I find hope in, I continue to find hope in organizing and people. I think about two distinct things right now. One is just our We the Tenants campaign. Mm-hmm. And there are these women who have been a part of our campaign for some time now. We call them the Golden Girls. And at the last meeting, one of Miss Mary and Miss Hattie came. And, you know, when I saw them, they said, "Hey, girl, where you been? We miss you." And when I was about to leave, they hugged me and said, "You know, we love you." And I don't think we started that campaign thinking that we would, you know, fall in love with people. But I did, right? And I have so much love and gratitude for everyday people who decide to not let their reality be their permanent place in this world, right? And who see something far bigger for themselves and their families, and who find the strength to fight. I find so much hope in that. I think the other thing is just, beyond just that type of work, my own community, my own family, knowing their history, like you said, it just reminds you, you know, I often joke, I'm very churchy because my dad was a preacher and his dad was a preacher. And I really see faith, the practice of faith. And, you know, the good book says faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And that just, every time I think about that scripture, I think about liberation. We have not seen it, but it is, it is there, and we will get there, right? We will get there. And so I'm grateful for just that, the way I was raised and the way that that translates to the work that we do now. Cause this work is my faith in action. And so I'm grateful for that.
Yes. Yes. Well, what a beautiful way to land this amazing season.
Oh my God, it's the end.
It's the end of season 4. Can you believe it?
Oh, the credits.
Yeah, so we have to run through the thank yous.
We got to run through the thank yous. First up, all of our guests. Yes. My goodness, we've had powerful guests this season. And we just want to shout out every person and every person that schedules that person who got us to this point. Because this season has been a labor of love. Mm-hmm. And you don't know how hard people, how much people move around their schedules to make things work inside of our schedules. And so just so grateful for our guests and the powerful words that they brought on this podcast. And the invitation to join the work. Seems like always there's a group in church. Doors are opening moment. The doors of the movement are opening moment. And so we hope across any of these episodes, our listeners have found ways to plug into this very powerful, important work that's happening across these issues.
Yes, yes. We also, of course, have to thank our team, our wonderful, incredible team that makes this possible. Without
Emmy award winning team.
Yes. Can we submit our team for an Emmy?
Is there a podcast award show? There has to be something. By now.
We got
to
look it
up.
There
has to be right now. Somebody's typing
in the chat. That's what yes. Johnny's LOLing.
We should submit them at least for a People's Choice Award. At least for the People's Choice Award. Absolutely. Because they work hard.
Hard, hard. We got to list them out. On the ones and twos always, Johnny Wu Gabbert is here holding us down.
Holding it down. Every episode.
Flipped, all of the things.
Also, it's just so affirming. Always like, that was a good episode. Thank you, Johnny. Yes.
Behind the scenes, we have Angelo Vidal and Zoe Griffin. They have done everything from write copy. You know, when you click on little episodes, you see the little show notes.
You see the copy. You got the headshots. you know, the headshots, graphics come bios, to me, the team.
All of those things. Yes, yes, doing good work. And then, you know, jumped in about mid-season, but my beloved executive assistant, Valerie Lee, who has helped
get these
last few guests lined up to get the schedules coordinated.
She's basically, she's a co, because she's basically mine too, you know, some days of the week. She got my calendar down. So shout out to Miss Valerie for making that happen. Yes. Listen, this team, you think is Blake and Kayla, okay?
No.
We come into a room and it's all set up for us. And that is just a wonderful evolution of this podcast as we get ready to wrap up season 4. So shout out to the team. Shout out to the larger teams of Arch City Defenders and Action St. Louis, period. Because not only are they helping to stand up this podcast, they're doing the work that we talk about every day on this podcast. And they are working hard in this city, and so, you know, in this region, to make it a better, to transform it and make it a better place for our people. And so just shout out to the staff members, board members, everyone who just works every day and thinks about these organizations every day. We're just grateful.
Yes.
Music Minute.
Last two groups. Music Minute. Shout out to the artists that lent their music for season 4.
Yes.
We really appreciate y'all. We hope that this podcast helps get a couple little extra streams.
We really do.
And we look forward to featuring more St. Louis artists in the future. And of course, shout out to everyone listening to our voices right now.
Shout out to the people who let us know they listen.
Yes.
Like, I'm looking forward to, I love the last episode of Under the Arch. We have real listeners. We're not just doing this
because we like our voices. Listeners.
People listen to this podcast. People love this podcast. And it really is a labor of love. And thank you for all the advice and the feedback and the support and the amplification. And, you know, for emailing us subjects that you want to hear and retweeting us.
Just keep doing it. Even in the off season, keep doing it.
But it is the off season.
But it is the off season. So it'll be a little while before you hear. You never know when we might just pop in with a little surprise.
Because something might happen and we might have to have an emergency episode. That does happen in the city. And I suggest those listening, those powers that be, just don't do nothing that would require that to be the reality, you know? Because every once in a while, y'all just get off mark.
Yes.
So stay on the mark.
Yes. Stay on the mark. Wherever the mark is at this point, who's to know where the mark is? But we will listen. We're going to go into off season, but we will be back before you know it. Kayla did tease, maybe, is this the last season ever? We have not actually determined that. I don't want anyone.
It's not. We got to end on 5. If we do anything, we'll got to do one more. We'll be back for season 5. I can't get enough of it. I love talking to Blake. We're going to be thinking about it. We're going to be thinking about it in the off season, but it is the off season.
Yes.
And we have accomplished 4 beautiful seasons of Under the Arch, and you have plenty of episodes to go listen to because all of them are still very relevant.
Yes, they are. So we hope that wherever you are in your station of life, that in the next few months, several months, until you hear from us again, that you are well, that you are thriving, that you are doing good work. And as always, it'll be a little bit, but we will be back before you know it with more Under the Arch.
See you later. We have come so far to go.